Morgan Startup Series.
Hi, it's Chris Titley here, and as part of the Morgan's Startup Series, I'm joined by Al Rabadan, co-founder of Play Bigger. Al, thanks so much for being part of this series.
Pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Al, can you tell us about Play Bigger, the company, the vision, the concept, and how it all began?
Well, it began by me leaving the shores of Australia in the mid-90s on a chasing a dream, create a Australian technology company, and it was an incredible voyage. We created a company called Quaker Sports. It was Australian founded, and then moved across to San Francisco, built the company from there, took it public, all that sort of stuff. Saw it go to $1 million and back, $1 billion and back again, sort of survived that. Then moved across to Macromedia and Adobe and worked there for almost 10 years as one of the senior execs running that business. And then all that experience kind of, I felt like we really wanted to play back into the startup ecosystem. And so we created a company called Play Bigger. It's based in San Francisco. And our business is we do what we call category design for early stage technology companies. And we've had the pleasure of working with, 25 companies over the course of the last 7 or 8 years here in Silicon Valley. And we're heading back to Australia here pretty shortly to launch our new book. Actually, March 21st is when the launch is.
Fantastic. A lot of stories amongst that time since the mid-90s, but your views on back in that day, the Internet 1.0, the valuations and where they were then, and perhaps the resemblance of what's happening now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I was at Stanford Business School summer of 95, and one of the case studies we had was Netscape's pending IPO at that time. And we all had to read the S-1, which is the filing document for the IPO, and come back and essentially, tell everybody what the valuation was. And of course, how the hell would you know? But we came up with a number, I forget what it was. I think it was like $14 a share or something like that. And of course, it flew out the door. I think it ended up at 60, if I'm not wrong, the first day, which shows how much we really knew. But it did indicate the potential of this thing called the World Wide Web. And then we lived at Quaker Sports. We lived through that whole 95 through 2000 acceleration as people really came to understand what this internet would actually do to our lives. It would fundamentally change the way we live, consume entertainment, watch news, talk to each other, the whole thing. And as I said, we founded a company. It was a digital sports company, and we felt like we wanted to tell the story of sport in a different way. It wasn't just a broadcaster explaining what was going on. We let the athletes do their own thing, and we used digital media in a big way. We felt like data was more valuable than video in this medium, which, of course, has turned out to be very true. So it was an incredible journey. It came to an end, a pretty ugly end for most of us. In 2000, when essentially the advertising budgets just stopped because people couldn't really see the return on investment or didn't know how to measure it. And but of course, that was just a really small blip in the radar here. If you look at it over the longer term, since then, the medium itself and the companies that survived through that period have just taken off. So just a fascinating ride. And, we're clearly in a whole new phase of, what we would call the internet today. And there's pretty much the same kind of excitement, I think, over the course of the last 4 or 5 years as we felt in the early days back in the mid-90s.
You said that you took your company over from Australia to the US. You listed it. It went up and ended badly. I mean, what's the major or the lesson in hindsight that you took from that business and the learnings from that?
Well, we did. It was founded in 1995, based out of Australia, based out of Melbourne. And at the time, I finished my sort of Stanford Business School summer, and I came back, and my co-founder John Burton and I sort of went and met with most of what you would call the VCs, although they were mainly private equity folks back then, to look for investment. Didn't really feel comfortable with anybody. Could have got the money, but didn't feel comfortable. So we decided if we really wanted to play in the global game, we needed to move to San Francisco, which we did. We took on funding there, did 4 rounds of private funding prior to the IPO, took the company public, I think it was in 1999. The value of the company went to $1 billion pretty quick. And then, like I said, the market itself just hit the skids in 2000. And, you know, it was a sort of an uncontrollable slide in a lot of ways. I remember the revenue going from something like $20 million a quarter to two the following quarter. And it's really difficult to try and rejigger an organization when you go from 20 to two in revenue in a quarter. It just fell off the cliff. And there were hundreds, literally hundreds of companies that really hit the skids. We ended up giving most of our money back, you know, sort of shutting the company down in a pretty orderly fashion. And everybody moved on. And, of course, whether you're in Fox or ESPN or any of the other sports companies now, most of the folks from Quokka, you know, sort of resumed their careers inside of that. So if there's a lesson in there, there's growth at any expense is not always good. But it's tough when you're in that engine room and things are flying out the door. And the market's going crazy. It's tough not to be part of it. You know, the investors want that. Your customers want that. Your audience wants that. And I think we all collectively learned the lessons from that time. And I think it's been a much more steady kind of, you know, growth and development since that point. And that's good for all of the investors.
Yeah, absolutely. Living through that myself, a lot of hot money in that sector and a lot of overinflated expectations, which, as you mentioned, has now probably come back to a bit more slow and steady. You did mention before about the fact that you wanted to be a global business. Now, in amongst all the podcasts that I talk about, some sort of dominate their vertical and don't think about being global, and others just want to go from global from day one. What are your views on where startups should have their mindset from day one?
Well, I think the most exciting thing, and this is what we're really excited to talk about, you know, during the book launch and during our panel sessions that are surrounding that, is that we are at a point now where Australia can actually give birth to a truly global technology company. We've got the skills, got the capability, the money's there now. The VC community in Australia is actually, for the first time, I think, in the last couple of years, we're really starting to see VCs who could really cut it here in the rest of the world. There's nothing wrong with taking someone else's category, whether it be real estate or automotive, and applying it to a regional market. That is a very solid business. You can see in .com. as well as cars.com, you see Seek, you see a number of these regional category kings have done a spectacular job. And the research we've done, which we'll be unveiling here in March, shows that they've created about $20 billion of market cap over the course of the last 20 years. So quite an impressive development of regional category kings. Take a category that was in the rest of the world and bring it into Australia and then sort of expand or apply it from there. Great story, nice business. But the real money and the real value creation happens by starting global companies, and Quokka Sports and LookSmart were two of the early ones that were sort of early blips on the radar, I think, back in the 90s. But most recently, Atlassian is a great example of a company that was born basically global. It was meeting the needs of development teams, for the most part, around the world. And the scale of that business, of course, is, you know, certainly an order of magnitude, you could argue probably two orders of magnitude than a regional category king. And of course, their market cap at the moment, and these are all US dollars I'm giving you, their market cap is already $6.5 billion. So whereas the regional kings took, you know, sort of 20 years, call it, to get to $20 billion, this company, you know, basically got to $6.5 billion already. So 30 or 40% of that market cap already. And I think what we're seeing is a bunch of aspiring, and I'm really excited to meet these folks. I've met a few of them in San Francisco as they've flown through, but I'm going to be meeting them again. And there's a bunch of young CEOs who are actually trying to become global first. Now, the issue is Atlassian and these aspiring global kings have to now take responsibility for creating the category on behalf of the world. And, of course, the book we wrote, Play Bigger, talks about this discipline called category design, not unlike product design or experience design, industrial design. It's one of those things that companies do these days to be the what we call category king. And that's what we're starting to see. These young companies are taking responsibility for defining and designing their category. And that, I think, is a fundamental tipping point in the country's history. Atlassian was the first one for sure. You could argue Quokka and LookSmart in the early days, maybe. But we're going to see a whole bunch of these new companies emerging to aspire to be kings and take responsibility for the design of their category and build great products and companies around that.
Al, I hope you're correct, and I think we are on that journey to have another Atlassian or another category killer or another global player from our own backyard, and we do need that. And what you bring up in terms of market cap is very important about being a global business from day one. And now being an Aussie living in San Francisco, through all the Silicon Valley kind of creation and the, well, not creation, but certainly the uptick in the last 10 or 15 years, what can we learn as Australians from Silicon Valley? What have they done right? And do Australian companies obviously need to get over there and learn and immerse themselves within that ecosystem?
Well, the first thing is they sort of have an unfair advantage in the sense that, you know, there's an education system, there's access to capital in the case of the VCs, there's experienced entrepreneurs who have been through the wars, and so on and so forth. So there's sort of, if you like, there's an infrastructure for entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley like nowhere in the world. And so that's, in some ways, it's unfair. In addition to that, you know, the United States turns out to be the single biggest consumption of technology, especially, you know, internet and cloud-based technology in the world. It's certainly big regions like China, India, and some of the APAC regions are definitely going to be, you know, sort of approaching that as mobile has, you know, really, you know, moved into those particular areas. But fundamentally, there's an ecosystem or an infrastructure in place for entrepreneurs. And it's entrepreneur-friendly, it's got capital available, people willing to take risks and have big dreams and all of that sort of thing. And like I said, I have a feeling that Australia is at this tipping point where the regional kings have done really nicely, but now the global category kings are the ones that are going to take off. Atlassian was a fabulous starting point to get people to realize, actually, you can do this. It is possible. Yes, they have to spend a lot of time in San Francisco and the rest of the United States, and you will have to as an entrepreneur and CEO. It's just part of the journey. But it feels like it's the right time, and it feels like there's enough experienced entrepreneurs and money that's come back from those successful companies that it's starting to spin in a very positive way in Australia. And like I said, I'm really looking forward to our book launch and the panel sessions because, you know, many of these entrepreneurs are going to be there and we're going to be talking about this very issue.
A number of chats that I've had that people have sort of lived or at least been or immersed themselves within Silicon Valley, and you've been there longer than anyone that I've ever spoken to, but they talk about failure, and they talk about failure making you stronger and resilient. It's almost like that if you failed, you've kind of checked off one thing and you've moved on to the next thing, and you kind of, I wouldn't say it's a high five, and no one aspires to fail, but it's certainly on the journey of an entrepreneur, whereas I suppose in Australia, from my view, I suppose there's a little bit of a tall poppy syndrome in the sense that, oh, if you fail, well, that's too bad sort of thing. Can you extrapolate whether I'm seeing it right or whether there is a real emphasis on learning from your failures and being resilient within the Silicon Valley ecosystem?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Look, here's the truth. Nobody's perfect. Nobody makes the right decisions every time. And if you are, then you should be, you know, put on a pedestal. And the truth is nobody is. And not Steve Jobs, not anybody else. They've had their own dismal failures. But the point is you've got to fail in the right direction or in a positive direction. And each one of these attempts, Jeff Bezos has attempted many different businesses in Amazon, and he fails quickly. He identifies those areas which are going. He identifies the ones that aren't, and he moves on. And it's really just failure isn't thought of as a personal thing in the United States. It's thought of as a process thing, if that makes any sense, what I just said. It's not about me doing something because I'm dumb. It's actually me doing something, figuring out that's not the right direction, or us doing something, figuring out that's not the right direction, redirecting and going directly in a different direction. And so I think when you come to terms with that, when you understand that, and that's certainly what I have learned as an entrepreneur in San Francisco, is that no one really talks about it in the context of, hey, you failed. There are some circumstances where that has happened, and people have made really stupid, bad decisions and have repeated to do that two or three times. And then I think at that point people say, okay, well, we're probably not going to make an investment in you as an individual. But for the most part, failure is just seen as a part of, sort of the journey that you take.
Al, you mentioned earlier about your book. The reason behind writing a book is some, lots of thoughts in your head and lots of experience and lots of wisdom. Is that the reason to share those thoughts to the public?
It was part of that, but more importantly, what we found was, we talk to probably a couple of hundred companies every year, and we can only do four or five engagements. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And we felt like if we were going to take responsibility for this discipline called category design, then someone need to put it down in paper and hope that other entrepreneurs can take that, if you like, cookbook and learnings and experience and everything else and go apply it themselves. And so that was the real motivation, honestly, was to get the discipline of category design more understood, more debated. We still have, it's an early discipline. Think product design back in the 80s, experience design back in the 2000s. It's a similar kind of thing where you put out this concept, this methodology, this process, however you want to describe it, and people get it, take it, improve it, and, we just hope the ecosystem builds. And early indicators are incredibly positive. We have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in Silicon Valley who are taking category design and applying it. We teach a course at Stanford Business School on category design in conjunction with Anne Murico, who's just one of the legendary VCs of our time. And it's happening. And so that was the reason for the book. And then you'll be delighted to know that in addition to the Oceania edition, which is the one that we'll be launching in March, there's a version coming out in China, in Japan, in Korea, in Taiwan, and Vietnam. And so the whole Asia-Pacific region, I think, is really embracing this. And that's a very exciting thing, to be part of something that's bigger than yourself. It's part of a new discipline in management. And it's a super exciting time for us.
Yeah, it's super exciting, and congratulations on your effort, and it must feel proud, and certainly not from a monetary point of view, but something also giving back your learnings and your thoughts and watching people use some processes to end up becoming incredibly successful. While I've got you on the line, Al, and you're living and breathing Silicon Valley, what excites you in tech at the moment? You've obviously seen a lot of different cycles, particularly working through Macromedia and the Flash and the Adobe, the PDFs, etc. Now people are talking about driverless cars, and we haven't really seen huge adoptions of things like AI here and big data. But is there something out there that you're particularly interested in, and that's quite fascinating towards you?
I think the promise of artificial intelligence as a mega category is intoxicating, honestly. The algorithms we used to write back in the 70s when I started writing code in Fortran and those sort of languages, were pretty rudimentary and pretty bare metal. I have a son who just graduated in data science, actually, out of in San Francisco, and he's just started in a tech job. And I talk to him and I look at the algorithms he writes, and this machine learning and AI thing, there's really something there. It's a giant seismic shift, I think, in the way we think about the algorithms we put together. And I think it's a bigger movement than most people talk about. I know there's a lot of people who say it may be overinflated. Certainly there's a natural hype cycle for any of this stuff. But I think AI is one of them. And how that gets applied into a whole bunch of different vertical markets. Healthcare is one that we're super excited about. And the application of AI and machine learning in healthcare, stunning opportunity. You mentioned one, driverless cars. There's a company, an Aussie company, Aussie founder, called Zoox in San Francisco, blowing the doors off this area. And he did the smart thing, came across, coupled up with some of the great minds out of Stanford, and pow, that company's on a run. And that is, it's not, every day I see Google cars flying by with, you know, sort of the cameras, as well as I've seen some of the driverless cars as well in some of the sort of the more restricted areas. And it's going to happen in our lifetime, absolutely. And so that's one big area I really feel is ripe for the picking. But I think also these monolithic enterprise systems that have been around for years, ERP, supply chain management, human resource management, all that sort of stuff, they are all going to get smashed and atomized down to much smaller applications that are really targeted, and the cloud is just revolutionizing that. That whole thing inside the enterprise is really exciting. And then, of course, at a consumer level, I mean, holy smokes, you know, the opportunity for communication. And I thought Zuckerberg's, you know, F8 speech just last year about sort of changing Facebook from being, if you like, a social network to being a, quote, communication platform over a 10-year period. Now, that's a vision. That's a giant vision. And that's exciting. And so there's three examples, and, you know, I could ramble on all day, but they're the ones that sort of jump to the top of my mind.
We live in interesting times, and it's all to play for, and hopefully it makes all of our lives a little bit easier and more efficient, I suppose. A lot of things are a little bit clunky and routine-like, and if we can get some AI or some robot interference to do the things that maybe we don't even like doing, like driving long distances, etc., for us, it's going to be hopefully better off for society. But it's a fascinating time that we live in. Al, one final question. You've been around for a very long time. You've succeeded, you failed, you succeeded again. You're an Aussie, you're living in San Francisco, you see thousands of entrepreneurs. Like, what are some tips that you can give for aspiring entrepreneurs, maybe someone within their particular field that goes, hang on a second, there's got to be a better way of doing this?
Yeah, look, here's the tip. The tip is that creation wins. If you study this stuff, and we have, you find that every single product or service that we love exists because some crazy entrepreneur had identified an unsolved problem. And they just wouldn't sleep until they solved that problem. And if you look at the ones who have done that, what you find is that in the process, they create an incredible product, an incredible company, and the great ones, Benioff, Bezos, many of these guys, create a great category. And it's a magic triangle, the product, the company, and the category. And what I'd say to all of the entrepreneurs in Australia who are listening to this is, hey, give it a go. Creation wins.
Fabulous. Simple advice, just very simple and very to the point, and that's exactly what we need. We need people that have lived it and breathed it to help and to continue to continue this ecosystem growth. So, Al, thanks so much. Congratulations on what you've achieved in your life, and particularly with Play Bigger and the book and the impending launch here in Australia. Absolutely tremendous and fantastic. And thanks so much for being part of this series.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris. And the one thing I'd say to the entrepreneurs that are out there listening to this is, hey, go buy the book, Play Bigger. It's available on Amazon. Take a look, and if you like the kind of things we're talking about here, you're going to love reading the book.
Great, fantastic. Thanks so much, Al.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chris.